through negotiators Saeed Jalili in the second round of the presidential election on July 5. The 69-year-old replaces Ebrahim Raisi, who passed away in a helicopter crash in northwestern Iran in May. Political commentator Fuad Azadi expands on the remarks by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei.
Iran has a democracy. We elect presidents with direct popular vote. And Mr. Pezeshkian won the election. A lot of Western pundits, news outlets, were saying that since he's a reformist, he's not going to be elected. So shame on them. Today his presidency starts. And both in his speech and the leader's speech, you could identify themes that would direct Mr. Pezeshkian's tenure as Iran's president. I think he is going to try to fulfill the promises that he made during his campaign. And the country's leader, as you just heard, is in line with his full support for the new administration. The recommendation that the leader had was for Mr. Pezeshkian to focus on the economic improvement of the country. And foreign policy, the leader referred to the idea of not waiting for some event outside Iran to engage in the daily business of the country.
Iran has warned that any foolish Israeli move against Lebanon can spread instability, insecurity, and the flames of the war in the region. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the regime would be responsible for the unforeseen consequences of such a move. At least 12 people were killed when a rocket struck the Majd al-Shams village in Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. The regime has blamed Hezbollah, but the Lebanese resistance movement has categorically denied any involvement. Kanani said that Israel has fabricated this scenario to divert global attention from its widespread crimes against Palestinians. The Iranian foreign ministry spokesman also urged the U.S. to stop Israel from starting a new war, whose flames will engulf the Zionists. Let's get more from our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who joins us from southern Lebanon. Well, Mariam, tell us what has occurred from the time that this incident happened up till now, and if there are any new developments coming from either side, either from Hezbollah or from the Israeli side.
Well, it's surprisingly calm up until now, of course, despite some of the Israeli shelling that we witnessed and we heard throughout the night, actually, even in areas that are close to cities like Tyre, for example, which is densely populated. And this is an area which is not usually, of course, targeted by the Israelis. We know that they targeted the area of Abbasiyeh, which is one of the towns within the district of the Tyre, the city of Tyre. And we know from sources that what was targeted and what was shelled and destroyed actually was a medical supplies facility, and nothing that was, there were no casualties, there was no one there, it's not something military. So it seemed that the Israelis were attempting to show force in some areas and just trying to target certain places. There were also several attacks in even the west, the Bekaa area in Tareya. We know that there were also there was also Israeli shelling in that area as well. However, we do know as well from Israeli media that the Israeli regime's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is supposed to be arriving in the regime today, later at 4 p.m., and will be meeting with the cabinet, they say, in order to make the right decision or to make a some sort of a to take some sort of a decision on concerning the issue of Lebanon. And we have that continuous threats, of course, from the Israeli media, from the Israeli military spokesperson, from the officials saying that Hezbollah will be punished or Hezbollah will have to pay the price for what happened. yesterday, in addition to the fact that they are saying that this rocket is an Iranian rocket, and it is, of course, would be continuous Israeli propaganda, especially Netanyahu's propaganda, trying to play on the issue of the Iranian support for the resistance, saying that it is the Iranian rocket, it was the Hezbollah forces, naming even the logistic commander of Hezbollah, who was responsible for the launching of these rockets. And so all of these are basically trying to frame the resistance in a manner where they would probably strike Lebanon in sort of a way that would, where they would say that this is a retaliation. But we also know from sources, and we've heard, for example, U.S. officials saying that Hezbollah's resistance, Hezbollah has clearly sent messages to the United Nations that it was an Iron Dome rocket that was responsible for that attack, and Hezbollah was in no way responsible for what happened in Majd al-Shams. That is, of course, part of Hezbollah's attempts to de-escalate the situation. We also have other sources saying that Netanyahu, on his way back on the airplane, said and told sources also that what he really wants is actually just a few strikes against Hezbollah, that they do not want to strike the infrastructure of Lebanon or the Lebanese government for now. And so that probably means that the Israelis will go for some sort of heavy strikes in certain areas, which are similar to what we've seen before in the past in Adlun, for example, and some other areas in the border towns, as well as in the Bekaa region, where Hezbollah does have strongholds and presence there. And that would, of course, amount to a retaliation for what happened, despite the fact that Hezbollah has clearly said they are not responsible for it. There were at least three operations yesterday on the Golan Heights, but all did not include Majd al-Shams. They were all against military, specific military targets in areas where there were barracks, where there were artillery fire, and so on. And this Hezbollah made clear in their statements. We also, of course, see the political spectrum and the many calls that went on since yesterday. But we do hear from the early hours of the morning throughout the night, the Israeli warplanes did not stop hovering over the heads. There were even a breaking of sound barrier. And at any moment now, we can hear the sounds of course, the warplanes flying over our heads.
Yeah, there's overwhelming evidence also pointing to the fact that there, not evidence, but overwhelming information that points to there to be a setup, to be a false flag in order for Israel to have a reason to want to attack Lebanon. Some of those, maybe it's not worth even discussing, but it doesn't erase the possibility that that may actually be something that maybe Israel has done. We know that Israel has been involved in fabricating many stories when it comes to anything and practically many scenarios that involve the genocidal war. Is that something that may be a possibility, Maria?
It is a possibility, of course, especially with what we're seeing inside Gaza. And we saw that after the 7th of October, how much they used a lot of issues that turned out later on to be falsifications and only fabrications in order to go on with their genocidal war. But we also know that there is a lot of talk within if we may say, the U.S. context. And this is very important when it comes to launching a war on Lebanon. The U.S. is totally supportive of the war on Gaza, and they are continuously giving that support, despite the fact that we are hearing also claims from maybe the candidate Harris, Vice President Harris, saying that she wants an end to this war. And there is a lot of talk saying that this is probably something that would lead, that would be destructive for the Israeli regime. However, when it comes to a war on Lebanon, we continue to hear it. And even now, also, with the fact that we are getting news from sources, for example, from Axios, saying that there is a U.S. official who clearly said that Hezbollah was not responsible for this attack. This is probably also means that there still is not a green light from the United States, which is something that is very important. In the history of the Israeli and Lebanese confrontations, whenever they launch a full-scale war, it was always through a U.S. green light, and it was always through U.S. blessings. Now we don't see that happening, and so this is why the Israelis might go for certain specific strikes, retaliatory strikes, as they call them, or maybe strikes in order to try to hurt Hezbollah in some way or the other. They do have targets that they have not targeted in the past, or they might go for an assassination, especially since the military spokesperson named a certain commander who is Ali Muhammad Yahya. This is probably only trying to foreshadow the fact that they will attempt to assassinate this personality and this Hezbollah official. If that does go ahead, I think it will only stop at that, and we will go back to square one. We will go back to the normal course of confrontations instead of a full open and a full out war.
And maybe it's worth you mentioning again the fact that you have the Druze that were, in this case in point, whose lives were lost. I mean, are these Syrian Druze, and therefore they're not really Israelis by ethnicity, so to speak? And does that make a difference in this whole scenario?
It does make a difference. It's a bit complicated. Of course, as you know, the Druze community is a minority, both in Lebanon, Syria, and Palestine. And since the Golan Heights is occupied Syrian territory, these are Syrian population. This is an Arab population, and they have been there, of course, forever. This is not a Zionist settler area. This also makes a difference with the Israelis as well. Had it been, for example, settlers that have been attacked, maybe things would have been different for them. The Arab community is not as significant as the Zionist settlers, for example. This is on one hand. On the other hand, Hezbollah absolutely has no interest in targeting them. And there is some sort of a unity when it comes to those Druze with the Druze of Lebanon. And they look up to the leaders, for example, like Walid Jumblatt, whose father is Gamal Jumblatt. He is considered one of the main and very prominent leaders and figures in the Druze community, in the Arab history, of course, especially in this region. And so they look up to them. When Walid Jumblatt says that, of course, he's against the killing of civilians, but in one way or the other, he blamed Israel. He did not blame the resistance. And he said very clearly that if the Israelis decide to take on a war or to launch a war against Lebanon, we will stand by the side of the resistance. We will support the resistance and the resistance fighters. We also have a lot of figures within that community in Majd al-Shams clearly telling the media that this is not the first time that the Iron Dome platform or the air defense system of the Israelis is constantly making these mistakes. And this has previously led to destruction and to damages of homes and even to the killing and wounding of people. But now it so happened that there was a big group of people who were gathered in one place. There is also another example of people who said that they clearly saw the rocket come from the Jabal al-Sheikh, which is, of course, one of the highest mountains in the Golan Heights, where there is a military barracks, and Hezbollah has targeted that barracks. They clearly saw those rockets coming from the mountain into that football field. And so these are just, of course, testimonies proving that the Israelis, of course, have not cared about the Arab community there and continue to use, despite all this malfunction of the Iron Dome system or the defenses, which has targeted Arabs there in the past. And now also they could be just using this as a pretext in order to launch perhaps a bigger attack on Lebanon. Now, with all this said, of course, we also know that the Israelis do not need a pretext. They can go perhaps for a war. But this in itself is also significant, especially with the continuous statements that we see coming out from the Israelis. Well, at the same time, we do understand that community has been, of course, under a lot of pressure from the Israeli occupation forces, since what we have in the Golan Heights is an occupation, definitely.
Thank you very much for that. That's Maryam Saleh from Southern Lebanon. Thank you, Maryam. Moving on, more Palestinians have fallen victim to air and artillery strikes in Gaza as the U.S.-Israeli genocidal campaign continues there. In the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis, Israeli air and artillery strikes in different parts of the city took the lives of at least 5 Palestinians. Similar strikes took place in Rafah, the other southern city of the Strip, and the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza, where 7 more Gazans died as a result. Also in central Gaza, 4 other civilians lost their lives after the regime's drone hit a group of citizens in Deir al-Bala. Earlier, an Israeli bombing of a school in the same city took the lives of at least 36 Gazans. The resistance group Hamas condemned the strike, saying that it confirms the regime's detachment from all human values. According to Gazan authorities, the IOF killed at least 66 Palestinians in just 24 hours, bringing the total number of Palestinians killed since October 7 to over 39,300. Thousands have once again taken to the streets in Tel Aviv on Saturday urging Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to quickly reach a deal that would return the captives held in Gaza. Family members of the captives made the demands alongside anti-Netanyahu groups who have been holding rallies on a weekly basis. They have criticized the cabinet for taking too long to reach a deal and have called for Netanyahu's removal. According to the demonstration's organizers, the protests were held at 80 different locations throughout the occupying territories and included the former Prime Minister Ehud Barak. Anti-Netanyahu rallies in Tel Aviv have been going on since the beginning of Israel's genocidal war in Gaza. Venezuelans are preparing to cast their votes in the presidential elections on Sunday. Venezuela's current president, Nicolas Maduro, is seeking a third term in office. Maduro and his ruling party are facing electoral challenges, as the opposition parties have come together to support a single candidate. Edmundo Gonzalez is representing the opposition coalition and has gained his own traction. 21 million Venezuelans are eligible to take part in the Sunday election. The next president will stay in power for a six-year term beginning on January 10, 2025. With that, we come to an end for this additional World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran while shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
A window to Palestine.
I am Daniel Jadway, a citizen of Chile, originally from Palestine. Born like so many other Palestinians around the world in the diaspora, Chile has one of the largest communities outside the Arab world. It is said that we are close to 300,000, but we are millions spread across the face of the earth, far from our homeland, but committed to the identity, to the history and struggle of our people, of our land, which is and will forever be Palestine.
y será por siempre Palestina.
Hola a todos y a todas, muy bienvenidos.
Hello everyone, very welcome to the new episode of A Window to Palestine. Marhaba. Today we will analyze what Palestinian resistance is in the history of the last 100 years, because today in Palestine, to live is to resist. And the Palestinian resistance did not start on October the 7th, nor did it start with the other invasions and attempts to destroy Gaza in the last 20 years, neither in the first nor the second Intifada. The Palestinian resistance began at the end of the 19th century after the first Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland, when the first migratory flows began to materialize, the ultimate goal of those who has intended to take over the land of Palestine and expel its legitimate inhabitants from it.
De una u otra manera,
in one way or another, the Palestinian resistance has involved the entire Palestinian people over the last 100 years. Men, women, girls, boys, young people, professionals, artists, and workers of all kinds, and not just within the occupied Palestine, but also in the diaspora. In fact, when the partition of Palestine was being discussed in 1947, I mean the illegal partition that was carried out by the United Nations, an organization claiming to be the defender of the self-determination of peoples, Palestinian nation was the only party that was not consulted about dividing their land. Here in our country, the Palestinian organizations were already crying out and forcing the Chilean governments of the time to abstain and not join in the entire circus of subordinates to the North American Empire who approved a clearly illegal partition. To understand more, I invite you to see the following reports by our correspondent in Gaza, Huda Hijazi.
Lo que es la resistencia palestina.
Since before October 7th, Gazans lived in continuous clashes and difficulties due to violations and the Israeli blockade. They resisted the lack of freedom, wars, the high rate of unemployment and poverty, and the lack of treatments. However, they tried by every means possible to fight to be able to live and survive these situations. This population had objectives and goals to achieve, and despite having minimal possibilities, they wanted to have a normal life. However, October 7th arrived, and all this collapsed. Gazans went from living a normal life to living in a true hell.
Before October 7th, we had a normal life. We would get up, drink coffee in the morning, while the children got ready to go to school, and we headed to our jobs as journalists. Then we returned to our homes with our children and family. We had numerous difficulties and limitations imposed by Israelis. However, after October 7th, we wake up with massacres, we sleep with genocides, with a large number of martyrs and victims. There are times when 24 to 40 hours, even a whole week goes by without hearing from your children or speaking to them. I was going to graduate in medicine from Al Khartoum University in Sudan. When the war started, I had to come here to Gaza. At first, I started working as a volunteer doctor in different hospitals, such as Al Shifa Hospital, Al Nasser, and now in Kuwait. My main concern right now is my family, since I'm responsible for them. For this reason, in my work, I have two concerns, that of the patients and the injured, and that of my family, of knowing if they're well or not.
October 7th was the moment when the stormy battle of Al-Aqsa broke out, an operation that began the Palestinian resistance with the aim of ending the suffering of the Palestinian nation. It was hoped to stop the violations being carried out against the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the entire city of Al-Quds, to release the imprisoned Palestinians from the occupation prisons, as well as to break the siege imposed on the Gaza Strip. These are the demands that the Palestinian people have the right to have. However, the Zionist regime, with the full backing of the United States, waged an endless and bloody genocide against the Gaza Strip and committed rape and massacres against the Palestinian civilian population.
There are several reasons that caused the Al-Aqsa storm to break out. When a population is blocked for 7 years, it is normal for it to explode. When settlers and far rightists are allowed to raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the entire city of Jerusalem, it is normal for this to happen. The causes that caused the Al-Aqsa storm have not yet been solved, but on the contrary, it has led Israel to increase these violations. For example, now they are preventing Muslims from praying at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It could even worsen the situation in the entire area.
In this war, the Gazans have been forced to forcibly evacuate their homes and lands in the north and center of the coastal enclave. Now they live in tents in inhumane conditions. Despite all this, they assure that they will continue resisting until they return to their lands, since it is a legitimate right and they will not give it up.
The earth is part of the human being. I was born on this land. I live on this land and I remain in this place despite all the difficulties and conditions. Here we are resisting to live. We are fighting to make our lives better. We try to provide living conditions for our children. We strive and do everything possible to solve basic needs. I have now lost my job and everything. However, I try by all means to find an income to fulfill my responsibility towards my children.
For the Gaza Strip to return to what it was before and for its citizens to resume their lives, it takes a long time and a lot of effort and patience. But this nation assures that it is invincible and will manage to move forward. Before October 7th, the Gazans had a life, a home, dreams to fulfill and to fight for. However, now all this has been destroyed by the Zionist regime. They assure that their lives will never be the same again, and the most difficult thing for them at this moment is not knowing how to face the future that awaits them. Hoda Hejazi, Gaza, Palestine.
Both international law and the Universal Charter of Human Rights and the rights of men recognize the right to resistance through all forms of struggle to all people who fight for their freedom and justice. In this case, unlike the Palestinians who are willing to die in the land in which they were born and in which they have lived all their lives from one generation to another, on the other side, hundreds of thousands of Israelis, supposedly citizens of the Zionist regime, return to their places of origin, arguing that Israel is no longer a safe place to live. The Palestinians are ready for anything because it is the only place they belong to, and they will undoubtedly be there after the last invader leaves. I invite you to take a break because in the next section we will be talking with a very, very special guest.
Con una invitada muy, muy especial. Bien, ya estamos de regreso y los quiero invitar.
Well, we are back and I want to invite you to attend our talk with Susana Erika Aguilar Silva, a professor at both the National Autonomous University of Mexico and the University of La Salle. She is a PhD student in political science and social science.
La Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México. Muy bienvenida, Erika, ¿cómo estás?
Very welcome, Erika. How are you? Thank you for accepting this invitation. I want to start by asking this question. When does the Palestinian resistance go back in the depths of history?
En este largo conflicto.
Hola, ¿qué tal? Muy buenas tardes desde la Ciudad de México. Muchas gracias por la entrevista.
Hi, how are things? Very good afternoon from Mexico City. Thank you very much for the interview. And well, a question should be asked. I'm going to do a contextualization first to remember very quickly that if we're talking about the Palestinian people, we're talking about a process of forced displacements, of ethnic cleansing, of occupation, of an ongoing process of colonization, settlement, blockade, in the case of the Gaza Strip. And in this sense, this very brief account is useful to remember and to show that the popular resistance is a direct consequence of the series of structural violence that the Palestinian people have experienced for at least 75 years. This popular resistance obviously consists of a series of principles, methods, and of course, direct actions, both non-violent and sometimes violent, which we could say have been developed since the end of the 19th century. However, some sources and authors would say that this resistance has begun since 1878, when, for example, the Institute for Palestine Studies located the very first Zionist colony in Palestine. And from then on, we could deduce that at each turning point in the history of the Palestinian people, various forms of resistance organizations have been introduced and formed, even in fact since the Ottoman Empire, when through non-violent demonstrations the sale of the land to the Zionist movement was limited, and obviously also during the British Mandate, later with the Balfour Declaration. A series of peaceful demonstrations against this declaration have been documented, demonstrations against its content. And after that, important series of anti-colonial congresses were held, some of them headed and formed exclusively by Palestinian women. So it is also very important to keep in mind the activism and participation of Palestinian women in each one of these fighting processes. The Palestinian nation has had too many challenges. The Palestinian Revolt, the Nakba, the four Arab-Israeli wars, the tough moments of living in refugee camps in neighboring countries, during the intifadas, and then came the Oslo agreements that evidently have not given them their rights, and of course, the construction of the so-called wall of apartheid, the expansion and construction of new settlements, the constant sieges in Gaza, the violence in the West Bank, etc. So, well, sometimes it is difficult to track the beginning of this resistance in an exact year. But the objective is for us to see that there has been no episode in the history of the Palestinian people without various forms of peaceful resistance.
Thank you very much, Erica. I want to give the public the opportunity to ask you some questions. Let's see if anyone has any questions.
Hola, Erica. Mi nombre es...
Hi, Erica. My name is Julio Soto Vega. I am a teacher. I live in Florida and I work in the commune of San Ramon. And the question is, what forms of daily struggle do the Palestinian people have or carry out in their daily lives?
En su vida diaria?
Muchas gracias por la pregunta.
Thank you very much for the question, which is very interesting and very necessary to note. Because when we hear the word resistance, we practically associate it with the use of political violence. And that is not the case. We must remember in this context, for example, Resolution 3070 of the United Nations General Assembly of 1973, which explicitly mentions the legitimacy of the struggle of peoples to free themselves from colonial domination and subjugation by all possible means, including armed means, which we are not talking about that aspect on this occasion. And we should also remember that this resistance, in addition to being a right, is also conceived as a way of being and a way of surviving, as the Palestinians have expressed to us in statements such as the one they issued in October of last year from the Union of Teachers and Employees of Beirut's University. This gives rise to some expressions in everyday life, such as, for example, al-wajud al-mugvema, which means existence is resistance, or as it also has been translated as, to exist is to resist. On the other hand, it also makes us familiar with more and more with this daily practice of sumud, which is a term in Arabic that, for example, the Encyclopedia of the Palestinians has translated as the determination to live as normally as possible, even in the context and situations of violence. This is how they've managed to survive during all these years and promote a sense of daily peaceful resistance. It takes varied forms, ranging from literature and poetry to music, dancing, painting, caricature, cinema, embroidery, and they all have their own meanings. Each of these expressions have been very important, very worthy representatives, known throughout the Arab Islamic world and throughout the rest of the world in general. But it also includes actions of, for example, cleaning wells contaminated by settlers, the symbolic act of pushing back the border or the limits of settlements, training teachers, establishing cooperatives, associations, community foundations in all areas, such as health, education, tourism, information, maintenance of museum, planting and harvesting of olive trees. Add to these the so-called captive revolutions, even the actions undertaken from inside the prison by Palestinians, the adults and the minors, and of course, the call for boycotts, divestments and sanctions that has happened since 2005 in a bid to crack the war economy of the regime of Israel as much as possible.
La economía de guerra del Estado de Israel.
Thank you very much, Erica. Let's go to the second question.
Hola, Erika. Mi nombre es Manuel.
Hello, Erika. My name is Manuel Rojas Morales. And along this line, she would like to ask you if the intifadas are a chance of, let's say, massive resistance by the Palestinian people.
Hola, muy buenas tardes.
Hello, good afternoon. Well, in fact, it seems to me that we could even relate it to closer events. We must remember, for example, that in October of last year, the Secretary of the United Nations also told us that we have to recognize that the attacks perpetrated by Hamas, by Islamic Jihad, did not happen in a vacuum. It seems to me that the same can be said about the intifadas, that of 1987, that of the year 2000, because they were also the product of an unsustainable political situation and the result of the occupation. That's the case in the West Bank above all, but also in Gaza. Both intifadas were, we could say, moments of popular effervescence, which have highlighted the capacity for self-organization of the Palestinian people. This has caused the resistance to come to the surface and becomes at least visible and very much more. Social networks have actually helped to promote this resistance throughout the world and disrupt the normal life for these communities which have managed to conduct their daily lives in the absence of the Palestinian state. So there have been committees, the creation of youth committees, for example, and the task or areas of life that interest that age sector of Palestinian society. But we have also women's committees, for example, the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees that were founded in 1980, but that became visible after the first intifada, when, for example, the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between Peoples also emerged, which would later give rise to the International Solidarity Movement. Since, in 2001, this movement has received the cooperation of international activists, which precisely helps to coordinate them and bring them into contact with the rest of society in these daily actions. But without a doubt, the two intifadas have also been key moments for the study of popular mobilization in its peaceful form. Then they would also have to be seen as these turning points, not only politically in terms of conflict per se, but also in self-management, in mobilization, and in this constant struggle of the Palestinian people. Now, it is said that there have been two intifadas, but let us remember that this classification is also made by observers, by those who study this situation. We could perhaps talk about several more intifadas, but those recognized, let's say, by Palestinian historiography are those two important ones. They're certainly like pressure cookers, which in those years did tolerate and exploded in the face of this unsustainable situation of injustice, of occupation, of the political situation, of the non-existence of a Palestinian state.
De situación política de la inexistencia de un Estado palestino.
Muchas gracias, Erika, evidentemente.
Thank you very much, Erica. Obviously, the intifadas being known for the public opinion have to do with the proliferation of new communications technologies. The Palestinian people from the first intifada onwards may be the only ones in history that have fueled these types of social explosions so that the world can know about them and overcome the historical siege. But our gratitude, Erica, for your presence on our program, and I invite those who are watching us to take a break to return and continue learning more about the Palestinian diaspora in our country.
Diáspora Palestina en nuestro país.
Dear listeners, that was the first part of A Window to Palestine. You can listen to the second part tomorrow.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life.
همه چیز رو تعلیم داده.
It has taught us everything.
باید آموخت. باید فهمید.
We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
و اونگاه پیاده کردن این مفاهیم در واقعیت زندگی.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
القرآن يهدي للتي
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tone should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب
الله. This is. This
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Death with dignity is better than a life of humiliation. To me, death is nothing but happiness and living under tyrants, nothing but living in a hell. Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to all of you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to your very favorite show, For a Better Life. This is Nahid, having the honor of hosting you on another episode. As we are all mourning and showing our sorrow and sadness on the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam on the month of Muharram, and as these days we are taking part in the ceremonies of the anniversary of that incident that happened to our great Imam, today we would like to get to know him more. Today we are going to talk about the characteristics of that Imam, the savior of all people, the person who was going to be the way of guidance and a person who is showing us the correct way in our lives. When Imam Hussein was born, the beautiful pair of the princes of paradise, Hassan and Hussein, was completed. As soon as the news were received, the Holy Prophet came and said azan in the right ear and iqama in the left ear. This fortunate prince, who was the first to receive blessed salvia and to hear a beautiful voice, was named Hussein by the Holy Prophet. Hussein was so beautiful, like his namesake, resembling the most beautiful person in the universe. That is probably the reason our Prophet named him Hussein. He was the star of the Prophet and companion's eyes. He grew up with the love and attention of Prophet, being on his shoulders, having him love Imam Hussein and Imam Hassan alayhi salam. While during this time, it was the Prophet who knew what the destiny and fate have chosen for Imam Hussein. There was the Prophet knowing what the story of Imam Hussein would be like, as he has promised that Hussein is going to be killed on the deserted area of Karbala at that time. And he has even mentioned the way that he's going to be killed by the tyrants. in what happens in the story of Karbala. They all start from the letters of Kufis. On receiving numerous letters from the Kufis, Imam Hussein decided to set out on a journey. Before starting the journey, he sent his cousin, Muslim ibn Aqil, to inspect Kufa. 12,000 Kufis pledged to him. Also, the ruler of Kufa treated Muslim with kindness. Affected by the sentiments of the Kufis, he informed Hussein that the conditions were favorable for him to come. Therefore, Imam Hussein started his journey towards Kufa. And still, we all know that Imam Hussein knew the story and what he was going to face. He knew the promise of Prophet from years ago that he was going to be in the Battle of Karbala, playing the role of the person who is going to sacrifice, who is going to play the role of Islam, in the land on which no one except him and his companions was there to speak up the voice and the message of Prophet. Well, we are going to talk more about what happened on the battlefield and the reasons Imam Hussein chose this way for the sake of Islam after a very short break. Welcome back to this episode of For a Better Life. Previously, we started the discussion over the story of Imam Hussein being born, being the favorite of the Holy Prophet, being loved and supported by the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. Our Prophet stressed upon receiving knowledge of Imam Hussein, foretold martyrdom. As a result of the assassination of Hussein, such a warmth will be kindled in the hearts of believers that shall not become cold till the day of resurrection. And indeed, to this very day, tears have yet not dried. To this day, the people of Imam Ali alayhi salam, those who pledged themselves, body and soul, to Ahl al-Bayt, have felt in their hearts the painful bite of a loss which words cannot encompass, let alone describe. With Imam Hussein's last breath, it is as the joy and light of the world were ripped off our hands. Such was the brilliance of his leadership and the kindness of his heart. Ever since that fateful day, we have been but orphans lost in the dark, forever yearning to be reunited with the one we held most dear. Imam Hussein's sacrifice is a supreme example for us as the people who are living in this world to understand how to stand up against the falsehood. Thousands of pages of history of Imam are illuminated with the virtues, characters, and achievements. An important message from the tragedy of Karbala is that one can cut off the head for the truth, but cannot bow down in front of falsehood. He showed us what he has learned throughout the history. Like he showed us, the love that he has received from the Prophet was drowning him in the words of wisdom and in the world of understanding the true essence of Islam. As we have too many stories of his childhood and the way Prophet was treating them, I mean the great grandsons, like Imam Hussein and Imam Hassan, we know that our Prophet had them as their favorites. And he, learning all those messages, seeing the kindness, the brevity of his father, of both his father and his grandfather, he was there, knowing the fate, knowing how Kufis would behave, and still fighting for the battle of the way of righteousness. He was still fighting for dignity, for dying with dignity, which is better than a life of humiliation, as we started the podcast with, as we started the show with. He said to me, death is nothing but happiness and living under tyrants is nothing but living in a hell. He decided the death, which was accompanying him to the way of dignity, to the way of what his grandfather told him, what his grandfather instructed him the time he was growing up. Well, this was all we had for today on For a Better Life. Until another episode, I wish you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution endorses President elect Masoud Pezeshkian, authorizing him to form his cabinet and to begin administration of the country. Israel's airstrikes and artillery fire continue to pound various areas across Gaza as the death toll from the regime's genocide passes 39,300. And the people of Venezuela go to the polls on Sunday to choose the country's president for the next 6 years. Thanks for joining us. The leader of the Islamic Revolution has called on the new Iranian administration to engage with other countries, but to rely on domestic capabilities. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the remarks after endorsing Masoud Pezeshkian as Iran's ninth president. Ayatollah Khamenei said no international issue must hold up domestic work. The leader said the administration must give priority to ties with neighbors, countries that expand Iran's diplomatic reach, including in Asia and Africa, and governments that have helped Iran against foreign pressure. Ayatollah Khamenei also called for attention to the economy and the livelihood of people as a key domestic priority. He said that everyone must avoid divisions and schism and called on parliament and the judiciary to help the new administration fulfill its objectives. Iran's new president, Masoud Pezeshkian, says the country can overcome its problems with convergence and unity. Also speaking in the endorsement ceremony, Pezeshkian said that he seeks a powerful administration to fulfill its responsibilities. Pezeshkian said that he will remain committed to the policies outlined by the leader to run the country. He described serving the people as the main duty of his administration, promising justice and fairness. Pezeshkian defeated ex-nuclear negotiator Saeed Jalili in the second round of the presidential election on July 5.